The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Shane Snow. Shane is an award-winning journalist, celebrated entrepreneur, and the author of the best-selling book Smart Cuts, and he's the co-author of The Storytelling Edge. He is co-founder of the content technology company Contently, which helps creative people and companies tell great stories together. His writing has appeared in Fast Company, Wired, and The New Yorker. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of the Arts and recipient of Columbia University's Innovator Award for furthering the cause of journalism. He has a new book, and it's titled Dream Teams, Working Together Without Falling Apart. Shane Snow, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here.
So this is an interesting week for the podcast because I have two tapings, one today and one tomorrow, and they're both with individuals who have written books on how innovation occurs, essentially. So I tape tomorrow with Melissa Schilling, whose new book is called Quirky, and it focuses on individual innovators like Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, and Elon Musk. And Shane, your new book focuses on teams, and this theme comes up all the time in our discussions with the academic community because it's so hard to glean data from highly effective teams. Most of the academic research is focused on individuals, yet you write, quote, "I learned that this was how every other breakthrough in history happened, from the steam engine to stuffed crust pizza, when humans put their heads together," end quote. And so, the academics a lot of times fight this, right?
I mean, I think in part because it's much more difficult to measure. A lot of what I ended up studying and writing about in this book is how there's almost this sort of dark matter when you look at measuring teams and kind of what happens with teams where some groups end up adding up to much, much more than they ought to when you just put all the individuals together. And that's sort of a tricky thing to untangle and to sort out. You know, interesting, though, that, speaking of the academic community, there's some really interesting statistics on when you look at academic research that that they call basically breakthrough research. So papers from scientists or academics in these journals that get cited by more than 100 other studies and future research. So it's stuff that's more so influential that 100 other studies base their work on it. It's something like a factor of 6 times more likely to be produced by a team than by an individual. Which itself kind of proves the point itself.
Yeah, and this is the argument that I get into because they have been able to test or run data on creativity with individuals, and often these are like grad students who want like $5 for pizza, not always. But what they haven't really been able to study is like, oh, I don't know, a Second City ensemble that's played together for a year, or a symphony orchestra or whomever. So I like it because you also say that our common wisdom about human collaboration is flawed, and so I think it's not just sort of the academic committee, academic community. I think it's also about this sort of lone creative myth idea in America that we're always looking for like a lone savior.
Yeah, you know, the chitty chitty bang bang thing, right? Where Dick Van Dyke goes in the garage, you hear some loud noises, he comes out with a flying car. But that even ignores, first of all, that's never how it happened. But it also ignores that someone made that car in the first place. Someone invented the internal combustion engine. He got all the parts from somewhere. None of that was just something he invented out of thin air. You know, a lot of these studies that I believe I know the ones that you're referring to, where they have brainstorming groups where they bring in, grad students to try and come up with ideas. The conclusions that they come to are actually pretty solid with in the business world, too. When you have a group of people trying to solve a problem together, usually that group sucks worse than one person kind of in their own kind of isolated state working on the problem. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for it, but there's all these studies where they say, you know, a group of people playing tug-of-war, the more people they are, the less hard you pull, even if you think you're pulling so hard. Mm. And there's sort of this, part of it's a social loafing factor. You know, psychologically, you're not as important to the outcome if there's a lot of you. Mm-hmm. And part of it is something else. But the foil to that is this sort of paradox that, you know, most things that are important in the world, and especially now that we've kind of developed civilization to the point that we have, most important things require more than one person to get it done. You're not going to, even if it's as important as cleaning the stadium before, you know, the ball game opens, one person is not going to do that. And anything that's important that involves kind of creating something, inventing something new or innovation, is going to have to require more than one person. And so the thing that I looked at that's this great paradox is most of the time you put a random group of people together, they're not going to be as effective together as they would if you added them all up individually. But once in a while, you have these groups that vastly exceed that expectation. And these are the kinds of groups that change the world. And I would suspect that there's, you know, having spent some time at Second City, that there's actually a lot kind of buried in the dynamics of some of these groups that you see, where you know, these students, you know, learning to do comedy together, learning to improvise together. And some groups, I'm sure, you see something magical happen where they click and they just are so much better together than they are on stage doing stand-up alone. And that's, I think, that dark matter that is hard for the academic community to get a lot of time and funding to really look at.
Yeah, Steve Kerr and Steph Curry came to the show the other night, and Steve comes every time he's in town because he was a Chicago Bull. He loves comedy. But one of the conversations we've had in the past is the fact that, you know, the like those great Bulls teams, like these great Warriors teams, they tend to know where the ball is going to be. They sense where the other player is. It's like a great jazz ensemble. So that's definitely something that's sort of in the DNA of when you work together in that way. You know, this book is filled with amazing stories, and that's one of the great things about it. It's not just academic study, though it is. You do draw on real data. And since this is a Chicago-based podcast, I'd love for you to tell the story of those Chicago detectives who found themselves in Baltimore.
Sure, yeah. This is one of my favorite. I don't know why we didn't learn this in school.
Right.
It's one of my favorite bits of American history. So there's a group of Chicago detectives, and this is how the book opens. I would normally, the story is really fun, but since it's not at the end of the book, it's not ruining too much. But this book opens, it's the story of these Chicago detectives that find themselves in Baltimore investigating a case. And the case basically is that the president of this railroad company in Baltimore is worried about sabotage on his railroad line. There's a group of people, essentially, that are unhappy with the political situation at the time, and they're kind of causing trouble. And so he hires these detectives from outside of his town to go investigate. The long story short is the detectives discover that there's a bigger conspiracy afoot, and this conspiracy is actually to assassinate a congressman. On his way through Baltimore to Washington, D.C. Now, his congressman also happens to be from Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's sort of made plans to go and do all these rallies, kind of going through the country on his way to D.C., and these private detectives discover the assassination plot. So they escalate this to the congressman, and knowing that part of the problem is that the Baltimore police are in on this, or some members of the Baltimore police, mm-hmm. including the police chief. And so they escalate this, and the congressman says, no, I'm not going to cancel the tour, but help me out. And so what happens is there's this group of detectives that went on to be very famous. One of them is kind of the boss, kind of the orchestrator. One is this former NYPD officer who basically is the guy you want to kick down the door for you or to jump off the moving train. And another is sort of this master of disguise who's very good at getting information and doing disguises. And so the three of them basically conspire to protect this congressman. And what they end up doing is they arrange with the railroad company that hired them in the first place to investigate this other thing to basically fuck up the train schedule.
Yeah.
So the assassination's going to happen in Boston. He's supposed to get off the train in Boston, transfer, do a little speech, and then go on to D.C. And so they arrange for him to go out the back door of his speech. They put a disguise on him. They put a floppy hat and an overcoat, and they make him pretend to be disabled. Hmm. So then they carry him along as this sort of disabled brother of this family that's traveling, and they get in the train, and they change the train schedule. So actually, the term sidetrack comes from this sort of thing. Hmm. The train ahead of them goes onto a sidetrack and goes slow so that this train can run express and arrive as if it's the train before it.
Right.
So they do that. They show up to the train station. The bad guys are basically waiting. They're going to cause a diversion. A crowd of people are going to swarm this congressman, and someone's going to shoot him. The people are there waiting. They don't see the congressman disguised as a handicapped person. And they go across the platform. They get in the other train at the wrong time, and they get on the train to Washington, D.C. And one of the detectives stays up all night kind of watching the congressman on this last leg of the train. And then the conspirators are basically there waiting in Baltimore for hours and hours and hours, and they're like, where did this guy go? What happened? Mm-hmm. And finally, when they give up, it's morning, and that's the morning that the congressman steps off the train in Washington, D.C., for his own inauguration as President of the United States. And this was actually Abraham Lincoln on the way to his own inauguration.
Amazing.
And I love this story because, first of all, this could only happen in the 1800s, but they literally saved the president's life. Probably the Civil War would not have gone the way it did had these detectives not put a disguise on him, done this sneaky thing to outwit basically this giant mob of secessionists. And my favorite part of the story is that one of these detectives, so the guy who's the head of the detectives group, his name is Alan Pinkerton, who went on to become very famous. The movie Wild Wild West, I think, has a caricature of him in it.
Yep.
But one of these detectives, the Master of Disguise, is the first female detective in U.S. history. And she went on to become so good at detective work that basically Pinkerton had her form a whole female detective bureau so that she could supply lady agents to every case to help with disguises and spying and all these things that the male agents couldn't do. And the term private eye actually comes from her having stayed up all night watching Lincoln while he slept on the way to his inauguration.
So this is amazing, and it's a great story, and people don't know it, and it's cool that it's a woman police officer, but it really kicks off this exploration around what diversity means, and the idea that there is tons of research on this, that diverse teams operate better, but that's you can say that, but it does, like what we've talked about with the beginners, when you get a bunch of diverse people who aren't trained together in a room, it probably won't work. So it's and the other aspect of this is that we talk about is the idea around cognitive diversity, which I think is related also to gender in some ways.
Yeah, so diversity is one of the first foundational things I talk about in the book because it kind of lays the basis for the rest of the argument.
Yeah.
If we presume that in order to make more progress than we could on our own, we need more people, which is sort of an obvious presumption. Mm-hmm. Then also, it makes sense, and even all of the research aside from it just makes sense that if you have a group of people that all think the same, they're only going to be as smart as the smartest person in that group.
Right.
But if you have a group of people who think differently from each other, they're going to, one of two things is going to happen. They're going to murder each other. They're going to have conflict and fight, and they're going to go nowhere. Or their different ideas are going to add up to something bigger than anyone's individual idea. And this is where there's plenty of academic research, mathematical proofs about how this happens. You combine perspectives and experience and heuristics and predictive models and all these things. But the summary is, if you have a group of detectives that all have the same training, they all approach the problem the same way, they all think the same way, they're going to solve problems in a very specific way, and it might be a good way to solve problems, but they're not going to change the world, they're not going to make a breakthrough, and they're not going to find a more clever solution to things if they don't include other kinds of people in their investigating, problem-solving process. And this is where, the story of Kate Warren, who was that first female detective, her story was sort of mind-blowing for Alan Pinkerton because he realized this facts. He was like, whoa, I've been hiring all these detectives, you know, from police departments, you know, who are trained a certain way. But, you know, if I add other kinds of people to the mix, we're going to be even more clever than the bad guys. And that was sort of what it is. And gender becomes sort of a proxy, especially in those days. I think especially today in many industries, in many fields. But gender becomes a proxy for thinking differently, because if you live your whole life in one gender or another, even if you grow up in the same place, you have the same education, people look at you, treat you differently. You have different opportunities. You're invited to different things. You're disinvited to different things. And so the way you navigate the world changes. And even if you want to think the same, you necessarily will see the world a little bit differently because of the way that people have treated you, for better or for worse. And this is where, you know, the diversity thing becomes tricky in America, because we often jump straight to the physical things. You know, we jump to race and to gender, and those are areas where we've been very shitty in society. To people. And so that's why it's often very sensitive. But the fact is, those can be clues to someone having a different point of view that could be valuable. Well, in every case, it's not going to be valuable, but in many cases, it will be. Right. And that's sort of the founding point of any great team in history. You know, I look at these amazing teams across all these different industries and fields. They don't always look different. Mm-hmm. Often they do, but they always think different.
Yeah, absolutely. And the connect point, too, that I didn't even think of before is Lincoln learned something about this basically by building that team of rivals that consulted him, a bunch of people who thought differently and didn't even necessarily get along, but through that hopefully gave him the stronger advice and opinion and counsel.
Yeah, you know, my favorite, I love that. That's exactly right. My favorite epiphany that I had on this front was a couple of years ago I wrote an article. You know, most of the stuff I write is pretty benign, I would say, like, yeah, hopefully interesting and entertaining, but not controversial. And I wrote something controversial. And this MIT professor wrote an article in The Atlantic tearing me apart mm-hmm. for this controversial article. Mm-hmm. And he was right about some things. I disagreed on some things. But I decided I hated the guy. And so for a couple of weeks, I sort of stewed on this. And my friends were all like, oh, fuck that guy. He's such a slob, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah. Ad hominem attacks. Like, this guy's the worst. We're your friends. We support you. And after stewing on it for a couple of weeks, I wrote him an email basically saying, like, hey, I totally disagree with you, and would like to actually continue this argument, but also, like, I've, you know, kind of calmed down a little bit, and I thank you for taking interest in the subject. And he wrote me back an even nicer email mm-hmm. saying, you know, I do this a lot, and no one ever does this.
Right.
Yes, let's continue the debate. And we had this great dialogue, and he invited me to come speak at his class. Mm-hmm. And now, every once in a while, I have an article that's controversial, and I think about, before I publish it, before I send it to an editor, I think about who's going to hate this the most.
Right.
Oh, yeah, it's that guy. So I send him the article, and I've done this a couple of times, and I say, hey, would you mind tearing this apart, since I know that you hate my ideas? And he'll say, by all means, and he'll write me a critique that then helps me make my argument better. And he's actually asked me to do this once for him, too. And I think that's kind of... It also preserves your ego a little bit when you invite it.
Yeah.
And that's how we change our minds. That's how we make progress, is when we actually listen to the people who disagree with us or who think differently enough to passionately try to take us down. And that's what Lincoln did with his team of rivals. He kind of channeled that energy that could have been focused on destroying him, but instead used it to bulletproof ideas.
Yeah, you know, Bob Sutton, who wrote The No Asshole Rule, talks about this as creative friction, the idea of that. And you use a term like the tension zone, and I think it's very much the same thing, which is, you know, you don't get to truth, to invention, to innovation, to great comedy, to great music, without having this sort of battle that goes back and forth. And this is one of the great things about the book in general, which is you set up like, you've got to be diverse. This is what it is. Oh, but there's a problem. You know, and then you have to go to the next chapter to realize this stuff is nuanced. It's not just like there's a 5-point path to get somewhere. And in the case of the diversity stuff, you know, you talk about the fact that, you know, the research overwhelmingly shows us that these diversity programs and businesses, they don't work. And often they have the reverse effect. They make people feel more marginalized after they go through the program.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, it's sort of depressing. Part of how I got into this is, you know, like you mentioned at the top, I started a company about 7.5 years ago. My role now is I'm back to writing, but for 7 years, you know, I was running this company, and I saw my role change from the guy who made stuff to the guy who put people together so they could make stuff.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this question of how do you make a cultural environment where people feel good, where they can do their best work? How do you, you know, make them feel safe? How do you empower them? You know, and how do you make people become more than the sum of their parts? That was in part what got me going down this, you know, rabbit hole of research in history. And one of the things that was really troubling to me is when, you know, we realized we were 10 people and 10 full-time people, and we were all, you know, late 20s men who went to East Coast Ivy League schools.
Yeah,
and
right.
We had two interns. Yeah, and we had two interns named Warren. Like, that's how diverse we were, right? And you know, and I was like, yeah. And I remember having this conversation with my partner. I was like, oh my God, one day we're going to have an amazing person we need to hire to take the company to the next level. And she's going to walk in, look around, and walk right out.
Right.
And so that was initially what we, you know, my concern around this was. And so, you know, went and did what I usually do, which is interview a bunch of people using journalism as an excuse to learn about something, dug through all this research, and realized that even the heads of diversity and inclusion at the world's biggest companies realize that this is a problem, that you bring in people from different backgrounds who look different, who think different, and the first thing you get is conflict, the second thing you get is fear, and the third thing you get is some sort of cockamamie scheme to manage this diversity that then turns into people feeling bad.
Yep.
And so despite all of the research and everything that we know, anyone who's been on an amazing team, a group of people that because we think different, we just gel and jam and make something awesome, anyone who knows that that's possible gets really depressed really quickly when they see, you know, the, you know, all these banks that have millions and millions of dollars just in their diversity programs that it backfires. So that got me depressed. But then there is, of course, the other case study. And so, you know, in my own company, kind of workshopping a lot of the ideas that a few companies have gotten right, that a few organizations have gotten right, or that we've simply kind of missed when we've examined history, has been encouraging because there is, like you say, there are nuances. It's not the easiest problem,
yeah.
But it's, you know, like anything important, once the pieces come together in the right way, it's like a switch flips, and suddenly people, you know, feel like they can be themselves, and actually them being themselves and then disagreeing in the right way is important to the success and the survival of the group. And you get this really nice dynamic where people feel unified but also like they can be different. And that's, if you think about it, that's actually the story of America in some ways.
Totally.
Up until, you know, maybe not too recent history, but
I don't know what you're talking
early
about.
Days, it,
yes, of course. Well, in the improvisational attitudes, you see all obstacles as gifts. You know, you see what's in front of you, no matter what it is, as a gift to be used. And what I thought was really interesting, you used the sort of Daimler-Chrysler merger, and we all know how disastrous that was. But it wasn't disastrous because these two cultures got together and started arguing. It was actually the opposite of that, right?
Yes. Yeah. And this is... I love that you bring this up because this is one of those things that's counterintuitive, but like once you see it, it's like you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Exactly.
Daimler Chrysler, they spent all this money, you know, two giant companies, the Germans and the Detroit Americans. They said, oh, we have so much in common. We care about cars, blah, 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 and this is going to be great. Our strengths complement each other. They put the companies together, and then those companies ended up being worth less than one of those companies was a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then they split up and they sold the assets, and it was this disaster that's used in every business school case study. And everyone says that mergers don't work out because of cultural conflict. That's the big talking point. And there's a lot of research that, you know, that blames that. And when you look at any kind of partnership, or say you look at marriages that don't work out, often the advice that you hear is, oh, cultural conflict. This was, you know, for, say, my grandparents' generation, the excuse for avoiding interracial marriage or interreligious marriage, because if your cultures don't line up, if you have different values, then it's not going to work out. That's why partnerships break up. Daimler Chrysler is such a good example, I think, because the reason it broke up was the opposite. It was because they didn't talk to each other. the two companies, the leaders of the companies, they didn't want to create the conflict that would inevitably come from these two different cultures. Despite caring about cars, they cared about different things about them, and it was German and American, and, you know, there was a lot different. They spent all this money doing training sessions on, like, German dining etiquette and American workplace behavior so that they could understand each other's cultures. But then they kind of kept everyone separate. And they people, academics, researchers, tracked the lack of communication. And this is actually what ended up breaking it apart. The two CEOs of the two companies would spend weeks not talking to each other. Which, how do you expect, it's like a couple that spends weeks not talking to each other, how do you expect that marriage to work out?
Right.
And this becomes sort of the entree to this idea that, so what if you have different perspectives? So what if you think differently? If you don't smash those perspectives together, you're not going to get anything. It's like trying to cook but leaving the ingredients separate on the counter. And so this brings to the inevitable idea that if you want to make something better, you want to bake that cake, you have to mix the ingredients. And sometimes that's going to cause a chemical reaction that's painful.
Yep.
But if you can get through that, if you can manage that reaction, then you make something sweet and delicious. And this, when you dig into all these other failed mergers that fail because of cultural conflict, actually the story is they're afraid of the conflict, and so then they shut up.
Yep.
And they devolve into organizational silence. And so, you know, as human beings, we have this innate fear of differences. We have this fear of conflict. We fear that, you know, people who are different than us are going to club us on the head and steal our woolly mammoth steak and all of that sort of natural ingrained. We don't do well comfortably with different ideas and different people. But we are smart enough, we're evolved enough to get over that. Once we realize that those differences and that conflict can be advantageous, then instead of shying away from it, we can invite it. And by the way, that helps us preserve our ego, too. If we say, hey, tell me how you disagree and tell me how I'm wrong so that I can get better, so we can both decide together whether I'm really wrong in all the ways or whether there's a better third way.
Yeah. I was just talking to one of the researchers up at the Center for Decision Research at University of Chicago that we work with, who's specifically studying this idea that he thinks that like things like small talk actually shy you away from having the conversation you want to have, because what it appears is like we build up in our minds how bad these confrontations are going to be. And then when they happen, they're never nearly as bad as the lead up that we thought was going to happen. And it really prevents us from having important conversations to get to truthful places that are going to help us in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I actually looked at a bunch of research on small talk. I can't remember what I ended up leaving in. There might be a footnote, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But small talk is actually one of those kind of tricky ways to engage people who we might be kind of afraid of the conflict without actually engaging them. It's sort of another form of silence.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what he thinks.
If we can talk about the weather because that's safe, then you know, then we're filling the time and we're not fighting, but we're also not engaging in that war of ideas that's going to make anything. You know, talking about the weather is not, unless I guess we're a weather station, it's not going to result in
right.
any kind of progress.
Yep. Okay, so we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you for your yes and story, which is how we end all the podcasts. But before we do that, I was thinking of you as I was reading this book, because Shane and I talked previously on his first book, Smart Cuts, and he got to know Second City a bit. But we developed a thing since I last talked to you, and it's called Brand Stage. And what it is we sort of realized with some of our insight partners who were using focus groups that were like, why instead of replace the focus group with an audience and let Second City performers play with the concept. And I thought about, because you talk about focus groups and the idea that, you know, I think the quote was, everyday people tend to come up with everyday ideas. And our experience mm-hmm. in focus groups is that you're not getting truth. You're actually sort of getting this, like, it's like groupthink, the evil of groupthink. But people don't do that through laughter. They're either laughing because they think it's funny or they're not.
I love that. Actually, I need to come and check that out. That sounds like something I'd be interested in learning about.
Oh, yeah.
But no, and that's what I was so interested in Smart Cuts and writing about the Second City, is that sort of testing ground process for whether the joke's funny, whether the bit or the skit is working, is pretty brutally honest. Either people are laughing or they're not, and that's kind of the best feedback you can get. And I think, you know, what you guys do well with your students is you train them slowly to become immune to, okay, no one laughs, I'm not devastated. I'm not going to go home and cry in the shower wearing jean shorts. I'm going to move on to the next one.
Yes.
And so if you can build up that, you know, that thick skin or whatever it is, or use it as feedback of like, okay, that didn't work, on to the next one. That's great. And I think the problem with focus groups is there's all sorts of sort of psychological dynamics afoot. You know, you want to, even if you go in thinking that, that you're going to be fully candid and honest and whatever, and you don't care about the group, we want to be accepted by the group. Or if we're, you know, fourth of the world of rebels, if we're the rebel, we want to do anything we can to not be accepted by the group. Either way, the group itself changes the way that we talk and think. And also, yeah, most focus groups, we're gathering people who, you know, we imagine are going to buy that thing off the shelf because they're the average person that's going to buy it. But that average person doesn't have the ideas in their head for what you should do. It's someone who's much more extreme or who's going to take a much different lens or angle on that problem that's going to help you to find the solution. I fully believe that. And yeah, like you said, there's stuff in the book about that. I like the idea of comedy as an angle because that's how much more extreme a reaction can you get than laughter?
Well, and there was neuroscience to back this up. There's a couple of studies, but the most recent one was in China, and they studied the human brain, and they discovered that the part of the brain that processes a joke is the same part of the brain that has an insight.
Interesting.
And think about it.
Sure, I like that.
It's not a leap. Like, you know, a joke is essentially a pattern you think is going one way and it goes another. And then when you think about an insight, it's again that thing of like, I thought it was going to be this. No, it's that. So you're like, like the path between aha and ha-ha is not necessarily that far at all.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I wrote one time about the benign violation theory.
Yeah.
This humor researcher. I wrote an article one time. Yeah. And I mean, it makes sense. Why would that be processed some other way by your brain?
Yep.
That's fascinating.
Yep. All right, man. So I we could talk forever. I love the book, but we do have to wrap up. So
thank you.
I want to ask you for a yes and story. So we ask every one of our guests at the end of the podcast for a time in their life when they normally would have said no, but instead they didn't say just like yes, but they said yes and. I'm sure you have that moment, and some of that's in the book as well.
So I'll tell you about how I ended up in a swimming pool wearing a giant one-piece sequin unitard and a wig.
Excellent.
A few years ago, maybe almost 5 years ago now, I was going through a really hard time in my life, my personal life. That it was, the details don't matter, but think like cancer scare, divorce level, kind of hard time in your life. And I got through kind of the worst of it. And I said to myself, you know what? It's a new day. I'm, you know, turning 30 and, I have this new life ahead of me that I didn't think I'd have. And, so I'm going to start saying yes to things. And I said, I'll say yes to everything but meth. Mm. And methamphetamine is a no, but everything else I'll say yes to. And there's maybe a couple days after this. And it was kind of a joke, but also kind of like, I'm committing to myself. And I'm going through my office, and the company was maybe 50, 60 people at the time. So I'm going through the office on a Sunday, and these two guys are there. Two guys, I'm friends with everyone, but two guys that I hadn't hung out with that much. And they're there, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing in the office on Sunday? Go home. And they looked up, and they said, one of them said, we're planning an impromptu trip to Miami. And then the other one said, yeah, you want to come? And so I said, you know what? Yes, I'll come. Like normally I would say no. And I said, you know what? Yes. And it turns out that they were messing with me. They were doing a little bit of yes and of their own. The one, Jolo is his name, Joe Lopardo, he just made that up. And the other one, Joe Lazowskis, went along with it. And then I said yes. And so then they said, well, you know what? Let's book a trip to Miami. And so we did. So right there, we booked tickets to Miami.
Uh-huh.
And then they got a couple of other friends, and from this trip to Miami, I made the best friends of my life.
Wow.
And a group of people that actually helped me to get through this really hard time. But also everyone that ended up, and it was this group of misfits that none of us were really kind of that good of friends before.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have our own chat thread, and people have moved away, but we have our own chat thread that we still talk every day. And this is the group that after the Miami trip was so fun, And we made such a strong connection between all of us Misfits. We did plan another trip for Jolo's birthday to go to Las Vegas so that we could enter him in a costume party and all support him. So we became supporting characters in this costume thing and kind of helped him to win a prize in the costume party. And that's how I ended up standing in a swimming pool wearing a one-piece sequin onesie, which I would never have found myself doing if it wasn't for saying yes to their little joke to going to Miami.
One of the most unique yes and stories we've had on the podcast. the book is called Dream Teams. Shane Snow, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.